I'm Jace Lacob, and you're listening to Masterpiece Studio. Before we go any further, I have to warn you, if you haven't watched all of Season 4 of Unforgotten, please do not listen to the rest of this episode. We usually try to limit our plot spoilers on this podcast, but with the shocking ending of Episode 6 of this season, we'd hate for this to be where you hear what happened. All 6 episodes of Unforgotten Season 4 are available now on PBS Passport. Go watch, and then come back here. Okay then, now, DCI Cassie Stewart is dead.
So we've come together today to say, all of us in our different ways, goodbye to our beloved Cass.
It's a devastating end to a traumatic season of Chris Lang's already gritty crime drama, featuring a nuanced exploration of murder, and this time, among a team of former Police Academy graduates.
For what it's worth, I did always think it was an accident, so not that that's any excuse, but it's been exhausting and running from my appalling mistakes all these years. And when I come out of prison, I hope I can live a simpler life.
For Unforgotten fans, the tragedy of the final episode is barely lifted by the news that this season finale is just that. A fifth go-around is in the works.
So we can be sad that we've lost someone we adored, and who we will miss every day. But we can also be grateful for the time we did have with her, and for the impact she had on all our lives. Cass Stewart was my colleague. She was my mentor. She was my friend. And I loved her.
Series creator Chris Lang returns to the podcast to discuss his heavy fourth season, what's still to come for the now solo DI Sonny Khan, and the value of a realistic internal examination of the police force itself in a crime-solving drama like this. And this week, we are joined once again by Unforgotten creator Chris Lang. Welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get into the specifics of this series case, I do want to talk about the elephant in the room, namely the departure of Nicola Walker from Unforgotten. When in the process did you know that you'd be tying up Cassie's story in this series?
Probably somewhere between series 2 and 3. It was a kind of ongoing discussion between us, between Nicola and I. And it was about neither of us, I guess, wanting to become complacent, neither of us wanting to do something simply because it was easy or easier. We discussed various iterations of how she could leave. And in the end, I think we both wanted to do something that was final. So neither of us allowed ourselves to be tempted to take a slightly easier route, perhaps.
I mean, there is a sense, if Cassie does retire, that there is a sense of yearning, perhaps on the part of the viewer, that maybe she could be pulled back into things in a subsequent season. Instead, there is a sense of finality to Cass's story here. The penultimate episode ended with Cassie's car accident and the implication that one of the suspects at the heart of the story, Liz, Dean, Rom, or Fiona, could have been behind it. But the truth is actually less sensational, but far messier and more random. Was this a deliberate red herring to amp up tension only to puncture it with the reveal?
Yeah, completely. It was to subvert the genre, really. You know, it was structured very deliberately in that you saw her getting into her car, and then I deliberately had 4 cutaways to the other 4 suspects in their car. And we then learn it was, you know, a nondescript. I even got design right at the beginning to choose similar looking 4x4s. You know, they were largely sort of family people. So I wanted it to, you know, to be absolutely the audience going, well, it's one of them. And I obviously wanted to do that, to deliberately then highlight the opposite, which was a sort of pathetic conclusion to her life. Random, bad chance, to a degree occasioned by the emotional state she found herself in, you know, her exhaustion, her mental exhaustion, her distraction. But really, largely, it was just the random cruelty of life. And you know, in many ways, that felt like a fairly fitting end and an interesting sort of echo of some of the themes of the whole four series up until that point.
I mean, it does. The accident injects this notion of sort of randomness, of causality into Unforgotten, which is a show sort of about deliberate actions and inadvertent consequences. Life feels messier somehow with the randomness of Cassie's death. There is this sense of chaos that's introduced here that was really heartbreaking to watch, because it wasn't one of these suspects we've been watching. It is something that could happen to any one of us. Watching it during the pandemic, I think, especially sort of heightened that sense of chaos. You know, can you speak more about the sort of chaotic element that introduced in terms of the writing?
Yeah, well, it's something that is sort of close to my heart, having experienced it in my life, the random, brutal cruelty of life and how it can be snatched away from you when you have no expectation that it's coming. So I think but it's also something I think that everyone can relate to. And you rightly say that a number of the cases and the suspects in our cases have acted more deliberately, and the chaos that follows in their lives is more often the result of deliberate actions. To a degree also, there's a random element to their lives. It's that sort of sense of you know, you teeter on the edge of something, and the choices you make in the end could lead down a thousand different routes. And there's a slightly random chaotic element to all of our lives, but certainly to the suspects as well. So I think it does chime with one of the general themes, but certainly in her life, it seemed a cruelly random way to die, and yet still connected. It always had to have truth behind it. The roots of that accident came from her emotional and physical exhaustion from what 30 years of policing had taken from her.
And you're sure there are no other connections he's concealed?
Kid's a career car thief.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Speak soon. So the other car, Range Rover, they now know was driven by a 24-year-old car thief. He'd only nicked it 5 minutes before. Tire marks on the road support his claim that he braked hard. He said she just pulled out in front of him.
Jesus.
I mean, that is the thing that really hit home with me. Unforgotten is in many ways sort of the most humanistic mystery on television. And it does show the damage, physical and psychological, that crime creates to the victim, to their families, to the perpetrator or perpetrators. But it has also explored the emotional toll that Cassie has carried with her for, as you say, sort of 30 years of policing, that it does in some way feel like an inevitable ending for her character more than simply retiring. There has to be some kind of break. And we see her struggle with that over the course of this series, but this ending feels in some ways emotionally right.
Yeah, it was very tough. And as I said earlier, that, you know, I did deliberately made it uncomebackable for the reasons I already said. Two things. First of all, I wanted to write a series where your protagonist, your hero, didn't want to be there, did not want to do the job. I thought that was a really interesting dynamic. But I also was really keen to show the reality of policing. And, you know, too often in cop shows, you know, they're kind of superheroes and they absorb everything and anything without too much apparent damage. And so it was really important to reflect the reality for me, which is that, you know, it's a brutally difficult job and it takes an awful lot away from you. And of course, like any conundrum like that, some people will sail through it largely unscathed. But I read lots of research and I know that a lot of police officers, particularly ones working in murder squads, the impact is profound. And I wanted to show that. And, you know, there's a strong argument for saying ultimately it cost her life.
I mean, on a technical note, I mean, we've become very accustomed to a high body count on television, particularly on murder mysteries. But Cassie's death really does cut me and I'm sure many viewers to the core. It was shocking, but it was also deeply heartbreaking. In terms of the actual writing, how do you write a character death that feels powerful without being saccharine, emotional without being harrowing?
Well, you just have to be constantly on your guard that you're not, that you can express sentiment rather than sentimentality. And, you know, that's an evolutionary process, both in the scripting and then in the shooting and then in the post-production. And there was stuff we took out, even we shot it and we took it out because it felt slightly, like we were tugging on heartstrings. And I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to show the story. I mean, it was emotional and that's fine. It was very sad and it was very sad for all of the characters and actually for the actors. And it was devastating for the audience and me. You know, I watched that scene when Sunny arrives in the hospital and realizes that she's gone. And then, you know, we go to Peter Regan and her dad on the phone. And then we go to the eulogy effectively. And, you know, I must have watched that 30 times in various cuts. And it used to get me every time because it's really sad to see the characters go through what they go through because, you know, your piece of you is in there. So, yeah, you know, you've got to be, try and be truthful, keep it spare, don't overindulge. I think we hit the right tone.
You mentioned Peter Egan, and Peter has been amazing to watch as Martin over the last four series, but that final scene of him in the hospital was such a beautiful, heartrending scene to watch. Cassie's death is complicated even more by the voicemail that she leaves him, apologizing for her behavior.
Hey, Dad, me again. Listen, maybe I'm not going to get to speak to you today, so...
I just wanted to say I'm sorry. Again. Seems to be spending my life apologizing to you. And no excuses. Apart from to say, this job has just drained me. It's stopped me from being able to think straight, see straight.
But it's 10 and a bit more weeks and then I'm done and then I hope we can get back to normal. And
of course I get it, the will thing. And I just feel like a total failure right now. But I can be better. I will be better, I promise. And then for however many years we'll have together, we'll try and get back to normal. Back to street food on the South Bank on a Sunday and the B&B at Port Gravelle at Easter and you and me and Addy watching the World Cup and Meals asking when the interval is, and you pretending I'm serious. All of it, Dad, and much, much more. It'll come back. It will. Anyway, you call me when you get this, and maybe I can take you and Jen out for dinner, clear the air. That would be nice, wouldn't it? I love you so much.
What was your intent with that reveal withheld until this precise moment?
Well, that's really interesting because that scene didn't make its way into the script until really late in the process because I was struggling. I there was no way I was ever going to write her, have a sort of deathbed scene where she sort of suddenly regained consciousness and was able to say all the things we wanted her to say. And so in the first three or four drafts of the script, I just had her, you know, in the bed and we never got that scene. But I knew something was missing. I knew it wasn't right. It felt rhythmically, structurally wrong to not see the living, breathing Cassie in the last episode that she was in. And I wanted to get her, you know, her vitality, even in the face of the vicissitudes, the myriad vicissitudes that she had or was in the process of trying to overcome. And then the idea came of the voicemail. And once I had that, actually, it's one of those little ideas. It just drops out of the sky to you and you go, ah, yeah. And, you know, you feel all warm and cozy inside because you know it will work. And it does everything you needed to do because it placed we were able to see her in the midst of this deep, deep tragedy. We were able to see her as a woman with a future and with hopes and dreams, which made the loss, you know, even more painful because she was absolutely trying to express the idea that if she could just get over this little hump, at which she believed she could, you know, and it was only another 7 weeks or something, and then we'll get back to who I used to be. And, you know, going back to your previous question, you know, we talked about how she would look at the beginning with design and with makeup, hair and makeup, and with costume. And, you know, you'll notice she's wearing exactly the same coat she wore in series three, because they said, you know, I think she's at a stage in her life where she doesn't go out and treat herself and buy herself nice things. And her hair was often unwashed and she didn't really put a lot of makeup on often. She just didn't look like she was loving herself much. And yet in that little vignette, as she sits in the car, she's talking about happier times to come and using the past to create those memories and saying, do you remember when, you know? And of course, all of those things she describes are things that are personal to me as well, little things that really touch my buttons. And I know Nick as well. She loves to go to Cornwall. She often goes and stays in a place just around the corner from where I often go and stay. And so I put that in as a nod to her personal story, because it's a special place for both of us. So it's just that, you know, seeing someone just nearly there after one of the most difficult periods of her life. And you think, if she, and every time I watch, I think, well, if she can just, but of course she can't. And that's life, you know.
Was there any concern that Cassie's death might feel like not just an ending for Cassie's narrative, but for Unforgotten as well?
Well, I think a lot of people felt that. I never did. But actually, I was quite pleasantly surprised by the audience's reaction. And by audience, I my engagement with the audience is on Twitter. And actually, although people were really pretty devastated, which I kind of expected them to be, and I think that's, you know, a reasonable, it's not an overreaction. These people come in, and I'm the same with lots of TV shows and my favorite characters. You know, you take them into your heart and they occupy a special place there. So it's absolutely, completely understandable to feel a real profound sense of loss. But I think they don't believe that that's all the show is, and of course it isn't. It's Sanjeev Bhaskar and Sunny. It's all the other team, the cops around them, and the pathologist and their boss. And then 50% of it is our antagonists, you know, those four guest stories that we get allowed into. And all of that wrapped up in this really robust format, which people really seem to like. So I you know, some people thinking, okay, the show can't continue without her. I never really doubted it, because there's so much else that they can hold on to whilst we're introducing a new character. You know, there's a lot of anchor points that will give them everything they love about Unforgotten whilst they're adjusting to a new character.
While this is the end, obviously, of Cassie Stewart's story, this is not the end of Unforgotten. We're getting a fifth series. Sanjeev Bhaskar's Sunny is likely getting a new partner, and of course there'll be a new case. What thoughts do you have about who Sunny's partner should be in terms of character? What are you looking to say with how the character is constructed?
Well, you know, there are some obvious things that you're going to do, which is she's not going to be Cassie. So I want it. It's a woman. I like that dynamic. And I guess that's about, that's where the similarities end. And, you know, he's got his journey, which is very important. And in a way, I guess what I want to try and do is mirror the audience's journey in accepting a new person through him, really, because he's got to let this new person into his professional and to a degree personal life as well. And the audience have got to do that as well. And so he's the vessel for expressing, I suspect, how the audience might feel, which is quite useful.
Is it true that Nicola put a note in Sunny's backpack to be found in episode 6.
It's absolutely true. And it kind of broke his heart. He wasn't expecting it at all. And he had a little blub because, you know, those two, Sanj and Nick, are really good friends. They've become, you know, we've been doing this show since 2014. That's a lot of time spent with someone, and they became very close. So it was really, you know, it was sad. It was a very sad moment. He put it on Twitter, and I think it made a lot of people have a little bit of a cry.
I did have a little weep. I did. I'll admit it. Every series of Unforgotten offers a twisty murder mystery, but this one was particularly serpentine. Four suspects, all previously in the police force, an historic murder, which is in turn threaded with issues of racism and sexual assault. Where did the idea come from, and how early on did you decide which of them had actually done it?
I decided very early on which one of them had done it. I always do. I always kind of know. I always know the bare bones of what the crime was and how it was committed and who did it and why, because I think everything springs from that. And in terms of the overall story, the bigger theme, about 10 years ago, I developed a series about the police, which was trying to really explore in my slightly conflicted relationship with them. We love them and we loathe them. In equal measure, often. I suspect it's not dissimilar in America. We think they do a brilliant job, a really difficult job, with great courage and selflessness often. And then at the same time, we recognize that it's full of often very, very flawed people. At least our police force is riven with corruption and dishonesty. So it's this two-headed monster. And so I wanted to write something that reflected that. And through writing it, explore and try and understand how I felt about them a bit more.
I mean, I do think it balances the struggles of Sonny and Cass with, say, Liz or Rom in a way that does sort of pay heed to that sort of complicated, conflicted relationship, as you called it, that we have with law enforcement. I am endlessly fascinated by Susan Lynch's DCC Liz Baildon, who seems so desperate to balance the scales of justice for her past that she devotes herself to a life of selfless policing and misery from her truly, truly awful mother, played by the great Sheila Hancock. What is your take on Liz and the lengths she goes to in order to try to redeem herself?
Well, she's a woman who, of course, never really knew the true depths of what she had stumbled across. She never really understood that someone had been murdered rather than there had been a catastrophic accident. And yet, you know, what they did, even if they'd thought it was a catastrophic accident, was still, you know, deeply immoral, slightly illegal, and they should not have done what they did. But, you know, she is and was always a very moral person. And so she's lived this life of reparation. I suspect she would have lived that a life of public service anyway. But it's made all the more acute by her past. And then as for the Dame Sheila Hancock, she's up there with Sir Tom Courtney for me. You know, I'd actually worked with her late husband, and I've worked with one of her children. So, you know, I'm keeping it in the family.
Her late husband, of course, being John Thaw,
who yes, played the lead in my first ever original drama 20 years ago. And I loved John, and he died very shortly after he made my show. I think it might even have been the last thing that he made. But I had a really lovely relationship with him. And then I knew his daughter and Sheila's daughter. I'd acted with her 30 years ago. So I'd always kind of wanted to get Sheila into something. And it was a delight when she accepted it. And I think she's about 84, 85 years old. But my God, she was... she'd give someone 20, 30 years younger a run for their money.
On the flip side, we have Ram Sidhu, who has risen to the rank of DCI. He's an alpha male with a chip on his shoulder, who then is revealed to be a bent copper. How do Liz and Ram's trajectories show differing reactions to the murder and to a sense of personal responsibility or accountability?
Well, she's a, as you say, she's a very moral person. She has a, you know, an ethical, really deeply ethical core and a selflessness and a devotion to duty and public service. And he's almost the antithesis of that. There was a line that we cut out, actually, which I sort of slightly regret cutting out because it really distills who he was. Because, he obviously one of the themes I explore in his story is racism within the police force and in general, historic racism from, you know, a man of his generation. And the interesting thing about him is that he did sometimes play, and I hate this expression, but it's kind of describes what he did sometimes, which was to play the race card. And yet at the same time, again, going back to that idea of two realities being possible at the same time, two conflicting realities being possible at the same time, he was the endless victim of institutional racism within the Metropolitan Police Force. And then a third layer to add to that, you know, he was also something of a narcissist. He was chippy and very ambitious and hungry for power in a not healthy way. And the line that we cut out was, isn't it possible, he said to his wife, isn't it possible that I have been the victim of racism all my life and I'm a bit of an arsehole? And I think that sort of distills who he is. You know, he's got all sorts of personal reasons for why he has this sort of vaulting ambition, a lot to do with his childhood growing up in Southall, in London, and watching race riots in the 70s and having racist abuse screamed at him through his childhood. And a lot of it's kind of, you know, I'm going to show you that I won't be cowed by that. He's got a slightly, we didn't have a huge amount of time to delve into it, but a difficult relationship with his father, who wanted him to either follow the family business or go into a profession, and he deemed police work to be below that. So he's got all sorts of personal reasons why he wants to scream and shout at the world, look at me, I'm good, I'm good enough. But he's, you know, he's a conflicted character who has a very bent moral compass in complete contrast to Liz Baildon.
Meanwhile, Fiona's life is, we'll call it a dumpster fire. And the thing that gets her in the end isn't the murder or the cover-up or even drunk driving manslaughter, but a forged license to practice. Do you see Fiona as a cautionary tale of a kind?
Well, another story of those things that you can scarcely believe people do and get away with. And I got a bit of flack on Twitter for that. Oh, you can't do that. That could never happen. Well, of course, I'd researched it, and yes, it had happened. And you wonder how people have the temerity to tell these gargantuan lies in their life. And it is the old Walter Scott quote of what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. You know, her deceit came out, all of it came out of this initial traumatic event. And I guess what I was again trying to say there was, from this one inciting incident, a whole life can sort of implode and then be reconstructed on very shaky foundations, on foundations of lies and deceit. And she was the most fragile of all of the characters, indisputably the most emotionally, psychologically fragile. And, you know, like a lot of people who have emotional and psychological fragility, she became a therapist. So, yeah, that's her story. And I also, of course, wanted to explore how a husband deals with something like that. And again, I quizzed my wife endlessly on what could she forgive in a situation like that. I quiz all my friends. I said, if I did this, this, and this, could you ever forgive me? And, you know, I sort of collate all the answers and then find what to people's breaking point, what they could take someone back for, what they would stop loving them for, and what they wouldn't.
And I do love Liz White in that scene where Fiona sort of vomits up all of this information to her children as though she's sort of purging herself of all of this. That was amazing to watch.
He actually died 18 months after I qualified, and I found out from his diaries that he hadn't wanted to be a police officer either. He'd done it to please his dad, so there's an irony there, isn't there?
Fiona, can you stop, please?
So in order to bury the unhappiness at where I found myself, I started drinking. A lot, and was in fact an alcoholic for many, many years, kids. I also became very depressed. And on two occasions, I tried to kill myself. I also, during this time, I made many, many mistakes, one of which I told your father about the other night, and which I need to tell you about too. So, in 1993, I killed a child in a car crash, which is just dreadful. But worse than that,
Fiona Grayson. Yes? I need you to come with us, please, Fiona.
Dean, the murderer and drug smuggler who has raised so much money for Down syndrome as a philanthropist, he says to the custody sergeant, tell his family I'm sorry. It was a terrible, terrible thing I did, and I've regretted it every single day of my life. So please tell them I'm so sorry. Is this Dean at his most honest finally? Has he truly been haunted by this all of these years? Is it a relief in a way for him to be caught?
Yeah, I certainly think it's completely from the heart. It's absolutely felt. This is a man who has been, as he said, steeped in violence in his childhood. And, you know, he's been trying to escape from those instincts that were inbred in many ways. And he has also, you know, for a large part of his life, led a very ordinary and morally respectable life. But imagine living, if you're not a person who is given to criminality on a daily basis any longer, imagine living with that, and you lead a fairly ordinary now family life with two children and a wife, and you've got to live with the fact that 30 years ago you murdered someone. I think it would torture you, particularly if your reaction to violence is so complicated. You have it within you, clearly, but you loathe it, you abhor it. And not everyone who's given to violence, of course, does abhor it. Some people, you know, it's a part of their nature, and they live with it, they use it without guilt. But he's not that. I think his confession is absolutely heartfelt.
Series 4 saw some of the show's supporting characters, Murray, Fran, Jake, and returnee Kaz, move a bit to the fore of the narrative. Can we expect that Series 5 might further explore these characters?
Yes, a little, yeah. As I've been writing, I've noticed just because of the dynamics of a new partner coming in, and there's a slight separateness, there's not that absolute twosome that Cassie and Sunny were. So there's a slightly more splintered nature to certainly that partnership, which means that everyone else fragments a little bit and goes off and does their thing a bit more individually. So yeah, we certainly see some of the officers taking on a bit more of the donkey work, not the donkey work, but of some of the more interesting stuff, the sort of more interesting interviews, because Sonny and his new partner are wrestling with lots of things, you know.
Chris Lang, thank you so very much.
Thanks, Jace. Lovely to speak to you again.
Max and Jake are mismatched middle-aged men with complicated personal lives and a strong dislike for each other. In other words, they're brothers. But when a gruesome crime forces the two closer together, they struggle to connect the dots.
You know what I liked? The butterfly release.
They paid for butterflies, then they had a cash bar.
It's beautiful.
It was buying out of order.
You've got no soul.
You've got too much.
We'll speak with Guilt star Jamie Sevis here on the podcast September 5th. Masterpiece Studio is hosted by me, Jace Lacob, and produced by Nick Anderson. Elisheba Etoup is our editor. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Suzanne Simpson.